June 3rd, 1876, Beaver Creek. It snowed on June 2nd, and because the snow made trailing harder, General Terry halted the expedition, permitting them to camp the entire day on Beaver Creek. It was a good place to camp because there was water and wood in abundance here. That allowed the troopers to fill their canteens and gather wood, not only for the current fires, but to take with them for future encampments when wood would be scarcer. Beaver Creek was not fordable for the wagons here, so a bridge had to be built. That meant that while the main body of the expedition rested, to the engineers it was just another day. They had already built several bridges since leaving Fort Lincoln, so building another one here was nothing new to them. Many of the troopers found things to do to keep them busy, but most played card games to while away the time, while others, well, they just slept in order to catch up on a commodity that had been in short supply from the moment they had left Fort Lincoln. Hunting had been fruitful for the last few days, and for the time being, there was enough fresh game to provide every soldier in the expedition with plenty to eat. Matter of fact, a few expressed the opinion that as far as they were concerned, they could just stay here for a week or two and then go on back to the post. While most of the men appreciated the chance to rest, Custer fumed over it, considering it a waste of valuable time. He also thought that letting the men stop and rest would actually have a deleterious effect on their military readiness. Not one to rest personally, Custer spent a lot of time with the scouts, sometimes even riding out with them. And because he had been on several scouting expeditions now without locating any significant engine sign, he tended to downplay the danger of too many engines when Falcon and Dorman gave their report.
What about the Gatling guns? Did you find them?
Yeah, we found them. The Indians managed to get away with one of them, but we spiked the one that they left behind. We also destroyed their supply of ammunition, which makes the other one useless.
Good for you. Good for you. You two men had quite an adventure, didn't you?
Yes, sir. If you call walking till your feet near about fall off the end of your legs an adventure.
Everything in life is an adventure, Dorman. I'm glad you men managed to get away without getting your scalps lifted. But I wouldn't worry about how many Indians there are out there. The thing to worry about is whether or not we can catch enough of them together to make a fight of it. Or if they'll just run away the way they normally do.
The next day, at General Terry's invitation, Falcon accompanied Terry down the Powder River to the Yellowstone, where the riverboat Far West was waiting. The boat, with smoke drifting from its high twin chimneys, made a majestic appearance here in the wilds of Montana, so far away from civilization. Captain Grant Marsh was standing at the head of the gangplank as General Terry and Falcon stepped on board.
Falcon McAllister, I thought you'd be back in Colorado by now.
Well, I thought so as well. Things have a way of taking on a life of their own. Now I'm acting as a scout for Custer.
Good for you. Custer can always use another good man.
Excuse me, Captain Marsh. Is General Gibbon here?
Yes, sir, General Terry. He arrived about an hour ago.
Have him meet me in the master cabin, if you would. Colonel McAllister, with me, please.
Falcon followed Terry into the master cabin, which was located on the Texas deck of the boat. There, Terry took out a map and spread it out on the table, holding it down at the corners with whatever he could find to use. After a moment, Gibbon came in. Gibbon was thin-faced, with a hawk-like nose and dark, piercing eyes. A native of North Carolina and a graduate of West Point, he had fought and was twice wounded for the North, though three of his brothers had fought for the South. A colonel now, he retained the brevet of Major General.
General
Gibbon?
Falcon knew that Terry was upset with Gibbon for not moving quickly enough. This meeting was 1 week later than he had proposed. But calling a subordinate by his last name without use of rank was the only way Terry expressed his displeasure.
I understand that your scouts have discovered a village on the Rosebud?
We have, yes, sir.
How large is the village?
I don't believe it's very large, maybe 100 lodges or so.
You don't believe? Can you be more specific? Excuse me, General, but isn't the purpose of your scouting to be able to provide me with such information?
Yes, sir, I suppose it is. It's just that I have no real way of telling how large the village is. My scout suggested that it wasn't a very large village, but their information was, well, let us say, inconclusive.
Inconclusive?
Yes, sir.
General, This is Colonel Falcon McAllister.
Colonel McAllister. Have we met, sir?
No. I'm not a colonel in the regular army. I'm a colonel in the Colorado Guard.
If you are in the Colorado Guard...
He is accompanying Custer. He is out here to look for Gatling guns that fell into the Indians' possession.
Good Lord, Gatling guns in the hands of the Indians?
And don't worry about it. The situation has been dealt with. Colonel McAllister found one of the guns and disabled it. He also destroyed the ammunition. So, though the Indians have the other gun, they won't be able to use it.
That may not be true, General.
What do you mean?
One of our wagons broke down and we had to abandon it. At first, we thought the only thing on it was canvas and tent stakes. Later, we discovered that there were 3 cases of ammunition on board. One of the cases was 50 caliber rounds for the Gatling gun.
And you didn't go back for them?
By the time we discovered we had lost them, it was too late. They were too far back.
All right. There is no sense crying over spilt milk. This is what I want you to do.
Terry pointed to the map, indicating where Custer was at the moment and where he thought Crook was, though he had no contact with Crook. He can only guess.
I'm going to send Custer up the Tongue River, then have him come down the Rosebud. I'll augment your column with 3 companies from the 7th and have you move up the Rosebud. If the village you saw is still on the Rosebud, we'll have them trapped in between.
You won't trap them, General.
What do you mean we won't trap them?
There are far too many Indians out there for them to be concentrated in a village that small. That was either a temporary village on the way to join one that is much larger, or the other Indians are coming to join it. In which case, it will become much larger.
What makes you think that there are that many Indians out there?
Have you seen no Indians other than this village?
Well, I did have some scouts encounter a war party that was big enough to prevent them from getting through to Custer. But I only had 2 scouts out there, so it didn't require that large of a party. We just haven't seen anything to suggest that there is a significantly large body of Indians operating out there.
I have seen them.
Have you now? And where was that, Colonel?
Colonel McAllister and Mr. Dorman recently returned from a very hazardous scout of their own.
I see. Well, I'm sure that to a colonel from the Colorado Guard, any significant body of Indians is apt to look very large. But I wouldn't worry about it. General, how soon do you want me to start up the Rosebud?
Not yet. I think perhaps I'll send a scouting party in strength to scout the Powder River to its forks, then to the head of the Mispah Creek down to its mouth, then by the Pumpkin Creek to the Tongue River.
Terry pointed out his plan on the map.
It just doesn't seem likely to me that there can be that many Indians operating out there, but I am not going to totally disregard the information given me by Colonel McAllister. I want to find out just what is in front of us. Obviously, any Indians out here are going to be by one of the rivers in order to take advantage of the water.
General, you know what will happen if you send Custer at the head of that scout, don't you? If he does find any Indians, he'll turn the scout into an opportunity to attack on his own.
You may be right. All right, I'll send Reno.
June 10th, 1876.
I don't understand why Terry sent Reno instead of me.
Custer was watching Reno leave at the head of 6 companies.
There is no way Reno is going to find something, and if he does, he won't have the slightest idea what to do about it. This whole scout is a waste of effort and a waste of time.
Well, why worry about time? We aren't on any kind of schedule out here.
Oh, but we are, Colonel Benteen. We are most definitely on a schedule. The 27th is fast approaching.
Oh, the 27th is approaching? I don't understand, General. What is significant about the 27th?
There is no particular significance about that date, Colonel Benteen. It would just be 10 days over a month since we took to the field, is all.
Falcon knew that Benteen was well aware of the Democratic Convention being held on the 27th of June because he had heard him talking about it in relation to Custer's ego. Custer turned toward Falcon.
Thank you for bringing the mail to me from the ferry. I had a letter from Libby.
I thought you might appreciate that.
Custer pulled the letter from his jacket.
Listen to this. The servants are doing very well. We are raising chickens. We have 43. So many cats about the garrison keep the rats away. The weather is very hot, but the nights are cool. The lights about the hills and valleys are exquisite. The river now is too high for sandbars to be seen. About 100 men with John Stevenson in command have gone to the Black Hills. Nearly 25 teams have passed by. Carter has returned and is chief trumpeter. He really sounds the calls beautifully. But his long-drawn notes make me heartsick. I do not wish to be reminded of the cavalry. Doesn't Libby write well?
Yeah, she does.
Did you know there are actually people who believe that she writes my articles for Galaxy Magazine?
Falcon had heard such rumors, but he didn't respond.
You aren't the only one who got mail.
Tom Custer walked up with a broad smile on his face.
Listen to this one, from Lorena. I watched Libby go about her day-to-day business, facing the world so bravely, knowing that her husband is now in the field and could at any day be engaged in the most terrible battle. I don't know how she maintained such courage. She is married to the general. You and I are but recent acquaintances, and yet I can't help but feel that there is something deeper and more promising yet to be discovered between us. And it is that feeling that causes me to feel such anxiety about your well-being that I fear I cannot hide it as well as does your sister-in-law. I can but only pray for your safe return.
That's a very nice letter.
Did you get one from Lorena?
No, I didn't.
Yes, well, it wouldn't have bothered me if you'd gotten one. I mean, it's pretty obvious which one of us she's chosen, don't you think?
Captain, I wouldn't have it any other way.
June 21st, 1876, mouth of the Rosebud. With Reno absent on his scout, General Terry moved the rest of the column to the Yellowstone, where they were able to set up their bivouac alongside the Far West. Custer was getting more and more anxious, and he started agitating Terry to let him go on his own to try and join up with Reno, then to strike at the Indians wherever they might be found. Terry held him back, but on the afternoon of the 19th, he had finally received a dispatch by courier from Reno.
We have advanced to the mouth of the Rosebud. We have found no Indians, but have found a very large trail with many hoof prints and lodgepole tracks leading to the valley of the Little Bighorn.
General Terry, what is Reno doing at the mouth of the Rosebud? I thought his orders were to examine only the Tongue and the Powder Rivers.
They were. He has exceeded his orders.
And put the entire operation into jeopardy. I told you, you should have sent me.
Custer, are you trying to tell me that if you hadn't found Indians on the Tongue or the Powder, you wouldn't have gone on to the Rosebud?
I may have, but it's different for me.
And how is it different?
I have experience with the Indians. If I had encountered them, I would have known what to do. I think we should all be very thankful that Reno did not find them. For if he had, the courier might have been bearing the message that his entire command was wiped out to the last man.
Oh, come now, Custer. That's rather a harsh appraisal, isn't it?
Are you saying that you don't think it's possible for an entire command to be massacred?
No. One only has to recall the Fetterman experience to know that it is possible. But Reno's command is much larger and more mobile, and there are three columns out here in pursuit of the Indians. So I think any talk of the loss of an entire command is a bit too much.
So, what do we do now?
Well, we now know where the Indians aren't. We just aren't that certain where they are. They aren't on the Tongue or the Powder, so they have to be on the Rosebud, the Little Bighorn, or the Bighorn. I want you to cross the Tongue, find Reno, then come back to the Far West.
I'll go find Reno and bring him back. But you should have sent me after him 3 or 4 days ago. We've lost a week with Reno's blundering. In fact, you should have sent me in the first place.
Yes, Custer, I am well aware of your opinion on the matter.
At 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Wednesday, June 21st, General Terry held a conference in the master cabin of the Far West. Present were Terry, Gibbon, Custer, Major Brisbane, who was the commander of Gibbon's cavalry, and by special invitation, Falcon McAllister. Custer took the first seat at the table as if it were his due, even though Gibbon outranked him. Gibbon and Brisbane also had seats at the table, and though Terry offered to have a chair brought in for Falcon, he declined and chose to lean against the wall with his arms folded across his chest and look on. Again, Terry had the map laid out on the table, held down at the corners with an ink bottle, a paperweight, a canteen, and a pistol.
Now, gentlemen, we know that General Crook is in the field, but we don't know exactly where he is. I wish we could coordinate our efforts with him, but that is impossible. In fact, it is going to be difficult to even coordinate our own efforts, but let us hope that our timing is good enough that we can converge in such a way as to prevent the Indians from fleeing and to convince them to return to the reservation.
They aren't going to be talked back onto the reservation.
Then we will convince them by force.
I'm glad we see eye to eye on that, General. A decisive victory over the hostiles now will, in all probability, end the Indian wars out here once and for all. And I intend to have that decisive victory.
General Custer, may I remind you that my men have been in the field much longer than you have. Brisbane's cavalry has been here since February 22nd, and the infantry has been here since early March. We have monitored and corralled the Indians for 5 months, waiting for this operation to begin. I do not understand what you mean by saying that you intend to have that decisive victory.
Why, General Gibbon, of course, when I say I am talking about all of us.
General Gibbon, while I understand what you are saying, I do intend to give the initial attack to Custer.
But General,
I... Hear me out. The 7th Cavalry is numerically stronger. Also, whereas your command is mixed infantry and cavalry, Custer's is all cavalry, which means if the Indians do attempt to escape, Custer will be able to run them down. Your column is half infantry, and no doubt as you move quickly, you will become separated, thus weakening your force.
I understand.
Now, you will not be left out. My idea is to have Custer move quickly and strongly against the Indians, forcing them against you as a blocking force. Now, here is how I propose the operation to be.
Terry put his finger on the map to illustrate his strategy.
Custer, I want you and the 7th to push up the Rosebud on the Indians' trail. Gibbon, you will march up the Yellowstone and Bighorn to a blocking position at the mouth of the Little Bighorn. If the Indians turn out to be on the Little Bighorn, Custer, you will attack from the south. And Gibbon, you will intercept any who try to get away to the north. Gibbon, how long will you need to get into position?
We should be there by the 26th.
Terry looked at Custer.
I assume you will have no problem getting there by the 26th?
I will have no trouble. General, what if we get there and don't find the Indians?
General Custer, once our columns are separated, you will be essentially on your own. I will give you written orders before you leave.
Very good, sir.
And in order to give you every advantage, I want you to take 4 troops of Brisbane's cavalry with you.
No, sir. No disrespect meant for Brisbane's cavalry, but I feel that the introduction of troops outside the 7th will just complicate matters. There will be the problem of command and control. I'm convinced that the 7th will be able to handle any situation that might arise. Besides, you said yourself that the 7th is already numerically stronger. Taking 4 troops of Brisbane's cavalry would only serve to weaken Gibbons's column.
All right, I'll accede to your wishes on that. Now, what about Gatling guns?
Again, Custer shook his head.
The Gatling guns with caisson weigh over 2,000 pounds. I think they would so greatly impede our progress as to take away the very advantage of rapid mobility you pointed out just a moment or two ago.
All right. It's just that we've brought them this far. I hate to not see them used, but you know the situation better than I do, so I'll go along with you on that as well.
Do we have any idea of the strength of the Indians?
My estimate, from what both Reno and Gibbon have found, would be from 800 to 1,000. You have something to add, Colonel McAllister?
I think you are greatly underestimating the number of Indians you are going to face.
How do you know how many Indians are out there?
I was on a rather lengthy scout with Mr. Dorman. We encountered Indians in great numbers, and they all seem to be moving toward one general gathering place.
Custer, given that, are you sure you don't want to reconsider taking 4 troops from Brisbane's cavalry?
No need, General. As we've discussed here, our biggest problem will be in catching them before they discover us and scatter all across the plains.
Oh, I'm quite sure they have already discovered us.
All the more reason we should move quickly.
All right, gentlemen, you can return to your commands and get ready. Custer, I'll have written orders for you in the morning.
Very good, sir.
Falcon left the stateroom when the others did, but Custer remained behind to have a few more words with Terry. Falcon stepped up to the rail and looked out over the bank at the soldiers who had come almost 1,000 miles from Fort Lincoln. Even the greenest and rawest recruits were now seasoned veterans of the march. But how they would behave in battle was another question.
Ah, Falcon, here you are. Come, we must get ready.
Custer turned when he saw Captain Marsh.
Captain Marsh, I'm disappointed that you didn't bring my wife up with you. I would have enjoyed seeing her again.
She wanted to come, and to bring your house guest with her. But I thought it would be too dangerous. Though the Indians have never made a major attack against us, they have taken pot shots at us from time to time.
Yes, I see what you mean. I'm sure you were correct in not bringing her.
I'll tell you what, General. When the expedition's over, and I return to Bismarck, I'll send word to Mrs. Custer, and if she would care to, I'll bring her back with me when we meet you at your resupply point on the way back.
Wonderful. I'll be counting on that, Captain. And I thank you for it.
Later that evening, the civilian reporter accompanying the expedition, Mark Kellogg, sought out Falcon.
It has been an exciting journey, hasn't it?
It has been interesting.
I wonder, sir, if I could prevail upon you to read the latest dispatch I'm sending with the next mail.
Why me?
Well, because, like me, you are not a member of the Seventh. Therefore, I feel that your appraisal of the article will be free of any tint of partisanship.
All right, if you think my opinion is worth anything.
Oh, I do, sir. I do indeed.
Kellogg handed a tablet to Falcon.
I know that it is a bit over-embellished, but I want the readers to get the feel of it. Know what it's like to be with the army on the march. Here, you may use my folding chair as a place to sit while you read.
Oh, thanks.
Falcon sat on the proffered chair and turned his attention to the pages Kellogg handed him.
At the mouth of Rosebud, on Yellowstone River, June 21st, 1876. From June 12th, the date of my last communication, until June 19th, the only occurrences of General Terry's command were the establishment of a supply depot at the mouth of the Powder River, and making the steamer Far West a moving base of supplies, having on board 30 days' rations and forage, the movement of the steamer to the mouth of the Tongue River with the headquarters command on board, and the march of General Custer from the mouth of the Powder River to the mouth of the Tongue River, an estimated distance of 40 miles, moving up the valley of the Yellowstone River. During the trip, no incident occurred, except the display of sharp rifle shooting on the part of General Custer, who brought down an antelope at 400 yards and nearly shot the heads off of several sage hens. The country north of the Powder River, for a distance of 12 to 15 miles, is very poor, low, and causing hard marching, with the soil producing no grasses, only sagebrush and cactus. En route, on the 15th, the column passed through an abandoned Indian camp, apparently less than a year old. It had been a large camp, being 2 miles or more in length, and must have contained 1,200 or 1,500 lodges. Game was very scarce, and no buffalo at all were seen. The Yellowstone is looming high, and its current is so swift, eddying and whirling as to create a seething sound like that of a soft wind rustling in the tall grass. Its color resembles yellowish clay at this point. It is cool and pleasant to the taste, and is a larger body of water than that of the Missouri River above its mouth, but very much superior for purposes of steamboat navigation. The waters of the Tongue River are of a deepish red color, running swiftly and not very palatable to the taste. On the 19th of June, General Custer, with 6 companies of cavalry, crossed the Tongue River, about 3 miles from its mouth, by fording, and marching to a point about 9 miles from where Major Reno, with 6 companies of the 7th Cavalry, were encamped, having returned from the scout he was ordered upon. But for some cause unknown to your correspondent, Major Reno was unfortunate enough not only to exceed, but to disobey the instructions of General Terry. Major Reno made an error in that he crossed, going a due south course, from the Forks of the Powder to the Rosebud River, where he found a fresh, hostile trail. General Terry had planned to have Major Reno return to the column, marching down the valley of the Tongue River, and after he had formed the junction, General Custer was to organize his regiment for a scout up the Tongue, thence across to the Rosebud, striking it near its head, thence down that valley towards General Terry, who in the meantime would move by steamer to the mouth of the Rosebud, join General Gibbon's command, march up that valley until he met and joined General Custer. The plan was an excellent one, and but for the unfortunate movement of Major Reno, the main force of the Indians, numbering 1,500, would have been bagged. As it is, a new campaign is organized, and tomorrow, June 22nd, General Custer, with 12 cavalry companies, will scout from its mouth up the valley of the Rosebud until he reaches the fresh trail discovered by Major Reno, and move on that trail with all rapidity possible, in order to overhaul the Indians, who, it has been ascertained, are hunting buffalo and making daily and leisurely short marches. In the meantime, General Terry will move on the steamer to the mouth of the Bighorn River, scouting Pumpkin Creek en route, with General Gibbon's cavalry as well as infantry, which are marching towards the Bighorn on the north side of the Yellowstone. This part of the command marched up the Bighorn Valley in order to intercept the Indians if they should attempt to escape from General Custer down that avenue. The hope is now strong, and, I believe, well-founded that this band of ugly customers, known as Sitting Bull's Band, will be gobbled and dealt with as they deserve.
June 21st, 1876, alongside the Far West. Custer issued an officer's call to bring not just the commanders, but every officer of the 7th to his tent.
Gentlemen, I'm allocating 12 pack mules to each troop. Prepare yourselves for a long, hard march. Take 15 days' rations of hard bread, coffee, and sugar, and 12 days' rations of bacon. Choose your strongest animals to carry reserve ammunition. I want a minimum of 24,000 additional rounds carried with the regiment. In addition, each man will be issued 100 rounds of carbine and 24 rounds of pistol ammunition.
What about sabers?
No sabers, Major Reno. We'll leave them here with the steamer.
The cavalry without sabers? That doesn't seem right.
The sabers will just take up more weight and space. Also, when a cavalry troop is on the march, the loudest thing you can hear are the rattling sabers. Besides, they are more ornamental than practical. Leave them here.
Yes, sir.
I hope you all understand that this isn't just probable that we're going to engage the enemy. It is an absolute certainty that we will. You do know what that means, don't you?
I think so.
Look around. Look at the man who's standing next to you. There is a very good chance that one or both of you may not make it back alive. So when you return to your encampment, I want you to write your wills. Have your men make certain that they either make out their own wills or leave verbal instructions as to the disposition of their personal effects.
Yes, sir.
Mind you, don't overly frighten them. Just make certain that these necessary details are taken care of. Gentlemen, we are going to follow this trail until we find the Indians, no matter how long it takes. That means we may not see the steamer again. So my advice to you is to take along several extra rations of salt. It could be we're going to wind up living on horse meat before this scout is through.
Later that night, Tom Custer invited Falcon to join him, Boston, Calhoun, Audie Reed, Keogh, Cook, and Weir. They all gathered around a campfire, drinking, joking, and laughing. Though Falcon had the idea that a lot of the laughter was forced.
Jimmy, my boy, do you think there will be any women in Fiddler's Green?
Now, why would I want to be worrying about women in Fiddler's Green? I'm married to your sister, remember?
Ah, yes. But once you get to Fiddler's Green, that won't matter. Do you think Maggie will never get married again?
First thing I'm going to do when I get to Fiddler's Green is look up Major Elliot and ask him just what the hell he was thinking by running off by himself like that back there in Washita.
Audie Reed had a terribly confused look on his face.
I thought Major Elliot was dead.
He is.
Then what do you mean you're going to look him up when you get to Fiddler's Green? What's so funny? Where's Fiddler's Green?
It's more of a what than a where.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, here's a poem for you, son. So when a man and horse go down beneath the saber keen, or in a roaring charge of fierce melee, you stop a bullet clean, and the hostiles come to get your scalp, just empty your canteen and put your pistol to your head and go to Fiddler's Green.
That still doesn't tell me what Fiddler's Green is.
Perhaps Colonel McAllister can explain.
Fiddler's Green is a place where the fiddler never stops playing and the glass never runs dry. It is a place where all cavalrymen go after they die. They go there to await the final resurrection.
Just cavalrymen?
Just cavalrymen.
Colonel McAllister!
Who's out there?
It's me, sir. Private Berkman.
Well, John, don't stand out there in the dark. Come join us. What can we do for you?
General Custer sent me to find Colonel McAllister.
You found him.
What do you need, Berkman?
The general's compliments, sir. And he asks if you will join him in his tent.
I'll be glad to.
Colonel McAllister, we'll be getting up a card game in Fiddler's Green. Will you be sitting in?
Not if I can help it.
When Falcon reached Custer's tent, Custer was writing a letter while drinking coffee and eating cookies.
Falcon, you are a pretty perceptive man.
You have something on your mind?
Are you going with us, or are you going to stay here with the steamer?
Well, I've come this far. It is my intention to go the rest of the way with you.
I wish you wouldn't. I wish you'd stay here with the boat.
May I ask why?
I just think it would be better that way.
General, if you are concerned about my rank getting in the way, I will tender my resignation to General Terry tonight and accompany you as a civilian scout.
No, no, it's nothing like that. It's just that, well, if anything happens, I don't want to be responsible for you.
Oh, General, I'm a grown man, and I've been in more than a few tight spots in my life.
I know. I just want you to understand that you have a choice in this. You are not a member of the 7th Cavalry. You're not even an active member of the Army.
General, you are in charge of this expedition. If you order me to stay on the boat, I will do so. but I very much want to go.
Custer paused for a moment, then reached over to his field desk and picked up a piece of paper and handed it to Falcon.
Here are my written orders from General Terry. Read them. If, after you've read them, you still want to go, I won't stand in your way.
Colonel, the Brigadier General Commanding directs that, as soon as your regiment can be made ready for the march, you will proceed up the Rosebud in pursuit of the Indians, whose trail was discovered by Major Reno a few days since. It is, of course, impossible to give you any definite instructions in regard to this movement, and were it not impossible to do so, the Department Commander places too much confidence in your zeal, energy, and ability to wish to impose upon you precise orders which might hamper your action when nearly in contact with the enemy. He will, however, indicate to you his own view of what your action should be, and he desires that you should conform to them unless you shall see sufficient reason for departing from them. He thinks that you should proceed up the Rosebud until you ascertain definitely the direction in which the trail above spoken of leads. Should it be found, as it appears almost certain that it will be found, to turn toward the Little Bighorn, he thinks that you should still proceed southward, perhaps as far as the headwaters of the Tongue, and then turn towards the Little Bighorn, feeling constantly, however, to your left, so as to preclude the possibility of the escape of the Indians to the south or southeast by passing around your left flank. The column of Colonel Gibbon is now in motion for the mouth of the Bighorn. As soon as it reaches that point, it will cross the Yellowstone and move up at least as far as the forks of the Big and Little Bighorns. Of course, its future movement must be controlled by circumstances as they arise, but it is hoped that the Indians, if upon the Little Bighorn, may be so nearly enclosed by the two columns that their escape will be impossible. The Department Commander desires that on your way up the Rosebud you should thoroughly examine the upper part of Tulloch's Creek, and that you should endeavor to send a scout through to Colonel Gibbon's column, with information of the result of your examination. The lower part of this creek will be examined by a detachment from Colonel Gibbon's command. The supply steamer will be pushed up the Bighorn as far as the forks, if the river is found to be navigable for that distance, and the department commander, who will accompany the column of Colonel Gibbon, desires you to report to him there not later than the expiration of the time for which your troops are rationed, unless in the meantime you receive further orders.
You read that, Colonel McAllister. Do you still want to go?
Yeah.
All right. You can go as a scout.
Thank you, General.
June 22nd, 1876, alongside the far west. At noon, after a full morning of preparation, the 7th Cavalry was ready to depart on its scout. Always the showman, Custer arranged for the 7th Cavalry to pass in review. The soldiers, even the newest and greenest of the lot, now looked like grizzled veterans with their beards and suntanned faces. They were wearing a variety of uniforms, light blue trousers with dark blue or gray, or in some cases, small print flannel shirts. Like Custer, Captains Tom Custer, Calhoun, and Keogh, along with Lieutenant Cook and Boston Custer, were wearing fringed buckskin jackets. The trousers of most officers and men were reinforced in the seat with canvas. Reno and Benteen were wearing regulation army blouses, but even they, like most of the other men in the regiment, had eschewed the army-issue capy cap in favor of hats that would offer better protection from the sun. Many of the men were wearing straw hats they had bought from the sutler from 25 to 50 cents each. Custer was completely outfitted in buckskin. He was wearing two English self-cocking pistols, ivory grips facing forward, and with a ring in each for use with a lanyard. He was also wearing a hunting knife and a beaded fringed scabbard, all three weapons attached to a canvas cartridge belt. His horse Vic was nearby, and in Vic's saddle scabbard was a Remington sporting rifle, octagon barrel, calibrated for the 50-70 centerfire cartridge. The 7th was formed and ready, but the order to move out had not yet been given, and Custer stood alongside Terry and Gibbon. The sky was gray and threatening. A rather strong northwest wind whipped the regimental flag, as well as the swallow-tailed red and blue banner with white-crossed sabers that was Custer's personal standard.
Major Reno, pass in review!
Forward!
Falcon rode with Varnum, Dorman, the White Scouts, Lonesome Charlie Reynolds, George Harrington and Fred Girard, as well as the Indian scouts, Bloody Knife, Mitch Boyer, White Man Runzen, Harry Moccasin, and Curly. They rode at the rear of the mounted troopers, but ahead of the wagons. Shortly after they passed, Custer mounted Vic, then galloped to the front of the column.
Now, Custer, don't be greedy. Wait for us.
No, I won't.
Lieutenant Varnum, what do you think Custer meant by that answer? Did he mean no, he wouldn't be greedy, or no, he wouldn't wait?
General Custer is a man of precise words. I think he knows exactly what he said, and he knows exactly how confusing his response was. Look over there.
Varnum indicated Gibbon and Terry. The two men were engaged in an animated discussion, and though he was too far away to hear what they were saying, there was no doubt in his mind but that they were discussing Custer's ambiguous response. The column moved up the Yellowstone for 2 miles to the mouth of the Rosebud. There, the Rosebud was from 30 to 40 feet wide and about 3 feet deep, with a gravelly bottom. The water was also slightly alkaline. And because of that, some of the soldiers who had intended to fill their canteens decided not to. Proceeding along the Rosebud and riding in the choking dust kicked up by so many horses, the column made camp that evening. Once they were encamped, Custer met with Falcon and the other officers.
Colonel McAllister, did you fill your canteen?
Yes, sir.
Why? The water is brackish.
I always take advantage of water when I find it. You never know when you're gonna need it. And even brackish water is better than dying of thirst.
Good, sir. Good for you.
Custer turned to look at the other officers.
Listen to Colonel McAllister, gentlemen. There could well come a time during this scout where you would give a month's pay for one canteen of brackish water. Tom, how's the pack train doing?
The mules are carrying just about the maximum they can carry, General. It's all they can do to keep up.
Well, tell them to do the best they can. As of now, we are to do all that we can to prevent the Indians from discovering us. From now on, all orders will be given by hand signals, verbally, or with couriers. Tomorrow morning, have the stable guards awake the troops at 3 a.m. We will move out at 5 a.m. sharp. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to discuss something that no commanding officer should ever have to discuss with his officers, but I think it needs to be discussed. I think that every one of you know that I'm willing to accept recommendations from the most junior second lieutenant in the regiment, provided that recommendation comes to me in the proper form. But it has come to my attention that during the march out from Fort Lincoln, my official actions have been talked about and criticized by officers of this regiment in contact with officers of General Terry's staff. I don't like that, gentlemen. I don't like that one bit. And I'm telling you now that all such criticisms must stop at once. If you have something to say to me, be man enough to say it to my face. Because know this, anyone I find guilty of such behavior will be dealt with to the fullest extent that Army regulations will allow.
General, will you not be kind enough to inform us of the names of those officers who are guilty of this? I mean, it seems to me as if you're lashing at the shoulders of all just to get at a few.
Colonel Benteen, I am not here to be chastised by you. And even though the relationship you and I have isn't of the warmest personal nature, I can tell you, for your own gratification, I will state that none of my remarks have been directed toward you.
Thank you, sir, for clearing that up.
Gentlemen, return to your commands. We came only 12 miles today. I intend, by an early start and hard marching, to make up for that tomorrow. Colonel McAllister, will you remain for a moment, sir?
Falcon nodded, then stood by as the regimental officers disappeared into the dark.
Falcon, while I refuse the offer of Gatling guns, I do not relish the prospect of a Gatling gun being used against us. At first, I wasn't worried, but the fact that Gibbon lost a box of 50-caliber Gatling gun ammunition has reawakened my concern. I would like for you to take one of the Indian scouts with you and range out some distance from the column to see if you can locate that gun.
All right.
You can take White Swan, Curly, Bloody Knife, or anyone you choose. Or, if you wish, you can even take one of the White Scouts.
I'd like to take Dorman.
So, you choose to take the Black White Scout?
Yeah. As you know, we scouted together before and we worked well together. I trust him in dangerous situations.
I understand your reasoning. If you want Dorman, then by all means, take him.
Then with your permission, General, I'll get Dorman and we'll leave now.
Falcon, this is the 22nd. If at all possible, I would like for you to rejoin the column by dark on the 24th.
Well, it might take a little longer than that. What about evening of the 25th?
That, sir, might be too late.
Falcon found Dorman checking a skewered rabbit that was suspended over a campfire.
Damn, but you have good timing. Here I thought I was going to have this rabbit all to myself, and you show up. Guess I'll have to share it with you.
You may not want to share it when you hear what I have to ask.
If that's the case, maybe I'd better share it with you before you tell me what you have in mind.
It isn't what I'm going to tell you. It's what I'm going to ask you. I'm going out on a scout, away from the regiment. I want you to go with me.
We're going to look for that other gun, ain't we?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, I heard that Gibbon lost a case of ammunition. Think the engines got it?
I think we have to assume they did. If they didn't, we haven't lost anything by looking for them. If they did, and we don't look for them, we could well ride into an ambush. And I don't have to tell you how much damage that gun could do on a column of men.
I can imagine.
Custer said I could take any scout I wanted, and I chose you.
Well, now, ain't I the lucky one?
You don't have to go if you don't want to. I can find someone else if I have to.
Now, here just a week or so ago, you said you wanted to marry me for my cooking. Now you're willing to run off with someone else. You sure know how to hurt a fella's feelings.
So what do you say? You go with me?
I'll go. I expect we better tell Varnum about it, though.
Falcon and Dorman were about 5 miles from the camp. There was no moon and it was very dark, but they were able to find their way by following along the bank of the Rosebud. Because the stream meandered back and forth, they crossed it about 5 times in the first 5 miles. When they reached a broken bluff, about 10 miles ahead of the camp, Falcon called out to Dorman.
Hold up there. I wanted to leave because I think we need to put some distance between us and the column if we're going to have any possibility of moving around without being seen.
I agree.
But we could be 100 yards away from the gun now and not even see it in the dark, so I suggest we stay here until daylight.
I ain't going to argue with you about that. No, sir, I ain't going to argue one little bit.
Shortly after Falcon and Dorman got underway the next morning, they came across the engine trail Reno had found. The trail was at least 100 yards wide, and the very ground had been plowed up by horses' hooves and lodge poles. It was easy to follow. The trail was a wide brown road that stood out vividly against the lush green grass.
Lord in heaven, how many engines does it take to make a trail this wide and this deep?
Thousands. Maybe 15 to 20,000.
I don't think the general has any idea about this, does he?
I think he believes the number will be somewhere between 800 and 1,000.
If there's 20,000 Indians, that means 5,000 or more warriors.
It was early the next morning when they spotted the gun. There were about 6 Indians with it, pulling it down the center of the road that had been carved by so many before them.
Ha! Pulling that gun, they couldn't keep up.
Let's get after him.
Hiya!
When they were within 100 yards of the gun, the engines turned and, seeing that they had the advantage in numbers, started galloping toward Falcon and Dorman. Falcon drew his pistol. The engines, armed with rifles and war clubs, suddenly decided that the better part of valor would be a quick retreat, and they broke away, 2 going to the right and 2 off to the left. Dorman started after those 2.
Let him go! We need to get the gun!
Reaching the gun, Falcon reined his horse to a stop, then a leap from the saddle.
Yeah.
First thing he saw was a broken axle that had been jerry-rigged. That the gun was heavy and had a busted axle, coupled with the fact that the engines weren't used to working with wheeled vehicles, made it easy to understand why they hadn't been able to keep up.
Now look there. Looks like they did find the ammunition Gibbon lost.
That's mighty interesting, all right, but maybe you better look over there.
Looking in the direction Dorman indicated, Falcon saw not the engines they had just encountered, but a new, substantial body of engines coming straight toward them.
We need to skedaddle.
Too late. As slow as these horses are, they would run us down. We're gonna have to fight.
Ain't gonna be much of a fight. This ain't like it was last time where we had something to be behind. This time we're gonna be standing out here naked as Jaybird.
Falcon broke open the box of ammunition.
Well now, what do you know? Sometimes you just get dealt the right cards.
The right cards? What you talking about? There's gotta be at least 20 of them heathens.
There are 10 magazines preloaded with 40 rounds each.
Falcon removed one of the magazines and put it into the breech.
Hold the horses.
Dorman took the reins of the 2 horses, then waited as the engines continued to gallop toward him. Falcon waited until they were considerably closer. Then he started turning the crank. With their blood at the boiling point, the engines kept coming. Falcon jerked the first magazine out and slapped another one in. By now, the engines had lost almost half their number. Realizing that continuing the charge would be foolish, the remaining engines turned and galloped away.
Ooh-wee! Yes, sirree, that gun is sure something.
Now let's destroy it and get out of here.
Destroy it? Don't you think we ought to take it back to the general?
No. In the first place, busted up like it is, I'm not sure we could even get it back to him. And in the second place, he wouldn't take it if we could. Remember, he was offered a battery of guns and he turned them down. And those were newer models than this one. This is an older model because it was going to the state militia.
How are we
going
to destroy it?
We'll fill the chamber with barrels of dirt. Then we'll smash the magazines.
For the next few minutes, the two men worked quickly. Falcon filling the gun with dirt while Dorman used the war club of one of the dead engines to destroy the ammunition magazines. With the gun destroyed, they remounted and left the trail they had been following, then went back to the Rosebud to rejoin Custer. The two men returned to the camp at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Custer smiled when he saw them.
Hello, Colonel. Did you find the gun?
Found it and destroyed it.
But not before he killed about 20 engines with it.
Really?
I think Mr. Dorman is exaggerating a bit.
A bit, maybe, but not much. When we found the gun, we was jumped by a bunch of heathens. But Falcon here turned that gun on them, just cut them down like a scythe through wheat.
I thought there was no ammunition for the gun.
Well, you were right to be concerned about the ammunition getting lost. The Indians had found it.
Well, I'm thankful you found it as well. I'd hate to think of having to go against that.
To be honest, we probably wouldn't have had to worry about it. The axle was broken. I don't think they could have ever put the gun in position to give us any trouble.
Nevertheless, you accomplished your mission and should be congratulated. Did you see anything else?
You might have right. We seen something else, General. You got any idea how many engines is out there?
All the signs indicate that the village might be quite large.
Quite large? The village might be quite large? Forget a village, General. I believe them engines is putting together a city. Going up against them is going to be a lot like trying to attack Denver.
No, I think not. Think about it. How would that many Indians sustain themselves in one place? They'd run out of wood and game very quickly, and they'd either have to separate or move on. And if there are as many as you say, that's ideal for us. Indians don't organize into a cohesive military unit. If they have 600 warriors, that means they have 600 individuals, unled and uncoordinated. And you do remember what Euripides said, don't you?
Euripides? I don't right to remember ever meeting a fella.
That's unlikely that you would have met him, since he died a long time ago. But he said, and I quote, 10 men wisely led are worth 100 without a head. No, my friend, regardless of how many Indians we may meet, the advantage is ours.
Later that night, Lieutenant Varnum came over to find Falcon, sat near a small campfire, getting ready to head out on a scouting trip.
Colonel McAllister, it'll be light soon. I wonder if you'd like to ride out on a scout with me.
Only if you quit calling me Colonel. That makes it a little awkward, don't you think?
Falcon and Varnum rode off on their scout. They had gone only about 5 miles ahead when Falcon pointed at something.
Lieutenant, look ahead. You see the smoke?
Yes. That's not just a few lodges, is it?
No, I think not. The way the smoke is spread out, I'd say that village is 3, maybe 4 miles from side to side.
They started forward again when Falcon saw someone coming.
There's Bloody Knife.
Good. I sent him, Mitch Boyer, and Charlie Reynolds out last night.
Seeing Falcon and Varnum, the Crow Scout rode toward them.
What did you see?
Many Sioux camped on Little Bighorn.
Where are the others?
They wait. Make sure Sioux not leave. From there, you can see camp.
Good, good. McAllister, you can wait here with Bloody Knife and the others if you like. I'll go back and get Custer.
It took about an hour for Varnum to go back for Custer. And when they returned, Reno, Benteen, and Cook had come along as well. The little group rode to the top of the ridge, where Falcon, Bloody Knife, Boyer, and Reynolds were waiting.
Now, what do you see?
Many ponies. Big village there. It is the biggest village I have ever seen.
Custer pulled a pair of field glasses from his saddle pouch and looked in the direction Bloody Knife pointed. He looked through the glasses for a long moment, then lowered them.
I don't see anything.
They are there.
How many?
We will find enough Sioux to keep us fighting for 2 or 3 days.
Oh, I guess we'll get through them in 1 day.
Custer lifted the binoculars and looked again.
You're sure they're there?
When they returned to the column, Tom Custer was waiting for him, and he asked to speak with Custer for a moment. Falcon watched the two brothers engage in an animated discussion. They were too far away for him to be able to hear what they were saying. When he saw Dorman a moment or two later, the Black Scout filled him in.
One of the pack mules lost a case of hard bread during the march up here. Keogh sent a sergeant and some men back to retrieve it, and they seen a bunch of Sioux opening the box. They shot at each other a couple times, and the Sioux run off.
Once again, Custer called a meeting of all his officers. Because of the heat of the day, Custer had taken off his buckskin jacket and was now wearing a dark blue army shirt, buckskin pants tucked into his boots, and a gray broad-brimmed hat. There was no insignia of rank on his shirt. No rank was needed to establish his position of command.
Gentlemen, it is beginning to appear as if we've been discovered, and my biggest fear is that the Indian camp will break up, scattering in all directions. So from this moment forward, we will have no advance elements. Instead, we will advance in force, find the village, and strike as soon as possible.
June 25th, 1927, McAllister, Colorado.
We advanced to the head of what's now called Reno Creek. There, Custer formed the regiment into battalions. Major Reno was given command of one of the battalions, and Captain Benteen was given command of another. Custer took command of the largest single battalion. Captain McDougal and his company guarded the pack train and brought up the rear.
And who did you go with?
Well, I'd been with Dorman for most of the time, and when they divided up, Dorman was with Reno, so that's where I went as well.
Falcon, do you recall about what time of day that was?
It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. Why?
You may recall that June 25th was a Sunday, and several of the wives of the post had come to my house for a Sunday prayer service. Our little group of saddened women, borne down with one common weight of anxiety, sought solace in gathering together in our house. We tried to find some slight surcease from trouble in the old hymns, some of them dating back to our childhood days when our mothers rocked us to sleep to their soothing strains. I remember the grief with which one fair young wife threw herself on the carpet and pillowed her head in the lap of a tender friend. Maggie sat dejected at the piano and struck soft chords that melted into the sounds of the voices. All were absorbed in the same thoughts, and their eyes were filled with faraway visions and longings, indescribable yearning for the absent men, and untold terror for their safety engrossed each heart. Please, continue, Falcon.
Oh, where'd I leave off?
General Custer had just divided his regiment into 3 battalions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Shortly after he divided the regiment into 3 battalions, they reached the creek that was known as Ash Creek, but is now known as Reno Creek. Custer ordered Benteen to take his DH and K troops and head south to a line of bluffs about 2 miles off at an angle of 45 degrees to send a well-mounted officer and 10 men in advance and to pitch into any Indians he might find. He was also told to notify Custer at once if he saw anything.
June 25th, 1876, Ash Creek. Falcon watched as Benteen and his battalion started off toward the south, toward the line of bluffs that blocked any view of the Indians who might be there. A rider approached Major Reno.
Major! General Custer requests that you ride down the left side of the creek while he rides down the right side.
All right.
Then, standing in his stirrups, Major Reno gave a hand signal indicating his battalion should cross the creek. At this point, the water was easily forded, and the hooves of so many horses kept a sustained splash of bubbles sparkling in the sunlight, until finally all were across. The regiment, minus Benteen's battalion, now proceeded down the creek with Reno on one side and Custer on the other.
I hope we ain't gonna need a pack train.
Dorman twisted around in his saddle. Falcon also tried to look behind him, but the pack mules were so far back that they couldn't be seen. They continued on for about 3 more miles, then came to a fork where the creek they were following joined the Little Bighorn. Here, Reno led his battalion back across the creek so that the two columns were joined. They spied a lone teepee. Falcon rode out to examine it, then returned.
There's a dead warrior inside. There's been a ceremony for him. He's laid out with his life possessions, including his bow and arrows and shield.
Very good. Burn the teepee.
Sir?
Burn the teepee!
A couple of troopers rushed to follow out Custer's orders, and in minutes the teepee was set ablaze.
Enemies!
Bloody Knife ran down the hill as fast as he could.
The enemy is advancing!
Some distance ahead, Falcon saw it. A party of warriors were galloping at full speed toward the river.
We haven't come this far to let them get away. Reno, take the scouts with you and push ahead at a trot.
Scouts!
Falcon joined Varnum, Dorman, and the other scouts as they moved out ahead of the column at a brisk trot. Falcon could tell by the gait of his mount that the horse was on the verge of physical collapse. Man and animal had been pushed hard for over a month now. Long, hard days and short, often sleepless nights with little food or forage. But the horse gave Falcon all it had, and for that Falcon was grateful. In Falcon's right front, he could see a huge cloud of dust boiling up from behind the high bluffs that hid the Little Bighorn Valley. When they reached Medicine Tail Coulee, which led down to the river at the central ford, Reno halted and they looked across the creek.
Major?
Falcon pointed to a spot in the distance. Here, for the first time, they could see the village clearly. It was large, so large that it was impossible to see just how large it was, because the other end of the village just disappeared in the distance.
Damnation!
When's the last time you seen something that big, Falcon?
Last time I was in New York City.
Custer and Cook came riding up quickly.
What do you see?
Falcon pointed to the village across the river. This time, Custer needed no binoculars. He could see the village quite clearly. Custer took off his hat and waved it over his head as his horse, Vic, made a couple of high-stepping circles.
We've got them this time! We've got them, boys!
When the rest of the regiment rode up, Custer held up his hand to halt them.
Trumpeter Martin!
The Italian trooper rode quickly to the general.
Orderly, I want you to take a message to Colonel Benteen. Ride as fast as you can and tell him to hurry. Tell him it is a big village, and I want him to be quick and to bring the ammunition packs.
The man nodded and galloped away.
Major Reno, I want you to cross the river here and attack the south end of the village. I will support you.
Yes, sir.
Colonel McAllister, you come with me.
Falcon, who'd been riding with Dorman and Reno, left Reno's battalion and joined Custer. Just as he joined, Boston and Audie Reed came riding up. Tom Custer was sitting his horse very close to his brother. He frowned when he saw Boston and Audie.
What are you two doing here? You're supposed to be back with the train.
If there's going to be any action, we want to be a part of it.
General, shouldn't we leave Colonel McAllister with Reno?
Why? Reno's never fought the Indians before. I have a feeling McAllister has.
Custer looked at Falcon for a moment, then he nodded.
Tom's right. You'll probably be more helpful with Reno. You mind?
You're in command, General. I go where you send me.
Falcon started to turn away.
Wait a moment, will you?
Falcon stopped until Tom caught up with him.
Tell Lorena. Tell her I think it would have worked.
Oh, Tom, if you don't want this situation to get any more serious, shouldn't you tell her that yourself?
Tom's response was a rather melancholy smile. He stuck his hand out in offer of a handshake. Falcon took it.
When you see me at Fiddler's Green, the first drink is on me.
June 25th, 1876. Little Bighorn River. Reno's total force consisted of 134 officers and men and 16 scouts. His battalion was just crossing the river when Falcon rejoined them. As the horses crossed, they stuck their muzzles down into the water, drinking briefly. Once Reno reached the other side, he formed his troops in a battalion front formation and sat there for a long, silent moment.
Custer did say he would support me, didn't he?
Yeah.
Reno looked down the long line of his soldiers. Not more than 1 in 3 had ever even heard a shot fired in anger. Though Reno had a sterling Civil War record, this would be his first engagement against the Indians. Reno raised his right hand high, held it for a moment, then brought it down sharply.
Charge!
Ahead of him, Falcon saw warriors coming out of the village, afoot and on horseback, preparing to meet the charge. but instead of closing the distance toward the charging soldiers, they began riding back and forth, raising a great cloud of dust. As Falcon saw this, he realized that the dust wasn't incidental. They were raising the dust cloud on purpose. They were trying to mask something. Squinting his eyes, Falcon peered through the dust, and as he did so, he saw a small ravine in which hundreds of warriors were waiting for him.
Reno! Look there!
Battalion, halt!
Major, no, we can't halt here! We have to carry through the attack!
One soldier, unable to control his horse, dashed ahead of the others, heading straight for the Indians. As he came even with the Indians, several leaped out of the ravine and ran toward him. He was knocked off his horse. The Indians gathered around him and began clubbing.
Dismount! Horse holders, retire to the timber! The rest of you form a skirmish line!
By doing that, Reno had immediately reduced the strength of his force by 1/4. And the soldiers remaining, no more than about 80, could stand no closer than about 10 feet apart.
I don't think we should have stopped.
Right. We're on the defensive now. A cavalry unit should never be on the defensive.
Some of the soldiers began firing, even though the engines were too far out of range for the shooting to be effective.
Cease fire! You're wasting ammunition!
Then hundreds of engines started rushing toward the little line of defenders.
Fire!
The soldiers were returning fire as rapidly as possible, but as they were using single-shot weapons, they had to extract the empty shell casings and replace them with new cartridges between each shot.
What do you think of this?
I suggest we get into those trees!
I agree!
Reno was about to give the order to remount when a bullet hit Bloody Knife right between the eyes. Blood and brain flew into Reno's face, and because his mouth was open preparatory to giving the command, some of it went in.
Mount!
The horse holders brought up the horses.
Dismount!
Some of the soldiers were mounting in response to the first order. Then some began to dismount in response to a second order.
Reno's panicked. He needs...
Dorman was hit in the stomach and fell to the ground. Falcon knelt beside him.
Get out of here, Falcon!
I'm not gonna leave you here.
Retreat!
Reno spurred his horse back toward the river. The others galloped after him.
Go! Get out of here!
If I get you on a horse, do you think you can hold on?
The engines were now within 100 yards.
I can try.
There was only one horse left. The Falcon managed to grab its reins, and he lifted Dorman into the saddle, then slapped the horse on its rump. The horse started toward the river, but it got no more than 10 feet. When Dorman was hit a second time, he stayed in the saddle for another 50 feet or so, then fell. The horse, riderless now, continued to gallop away, leaving Dorman on the ground and Falcon afoot. Engine swooped down on Falcon. He pulled his pistol. The others swerved around him and continued on toward the retreating soldiers. Falcon's first thought was to run toward the river, but he knew that in order to do so, he would have to run right through the middle of the attacking engines. That left him no choice but to run into the little thicket that had anchored the left side of Reno's original skirmish line.
McAllister, over here!
Falcon ran for the sound of the voice and jumped down into a shallow depression. There, he saw Lieutenant DeRudio and one of the sergeants.
Is Dorman dead?
I don't know. Right now, it's too hot out there to find out.
Colonel McAllister, good to meet you, sir. Sergeant Tom O'Neill,
good to meet you. Wish it was better circumstances.
Falcon could see the engines riding back and forth on the bank of the river, about a half a mile away, pouring fire into the retreating soldiers. Benny Hodgson's horse was shot out from under him, and the young lieutenant leaped into the water. One of the soldiers came back and extended the stirrup of his horse to Hodgson, and by holding on to the stirrup, Hodgson was pulled quickly across the stream. But when the pair reached the other side, and Hodgson let go of the stirrup and tried to climb up out of the creek, he was shot. At that precise moment, Benteen arrived with his troops, and they immediately joined into the battle, providing enough additional firepower to keep the engines from crossing the river. The frustrated Braves rode back and forth on this side, sometimes firing across at Reno's troops, and sometimes just galloping up and down, shouting, screaming. Falcon lay in the little ravine with the others for the rest of the day, and darkness soon moved in, and the river could no longer be seen.
If we're ever going to get out of here, now's the time.
I agree.
It was slightly overcast, and the moon was but a thin crescent. So when they moved out of the thicket, they were able to use the darkness to cover their movement. They couldn't see the river from there, but they were able to find their way easily by following the trail of dead bodies, Indians, soldiers, and horses. Moving downstream, they found a place where they could cross, plunging into the water. They worked their way to the other side. When they came ashore, they discovered they were on an island. In the dim glow of moonlight, saw that the other side was a high, steep bluff that would be impossible to climb.
Now what?
We're on an island. I think that means we'll be safe for the night. Let's wait until it lightens up enough to see what we're doing. And let the troops see us. I wouldn't want to escape the Indians, only to be shot by our own men.
Good point.
The three men waited through the night. Then, in the lighter gray of pre-dawn, they saw a body of men riding down the bank on the opposite side. They were in uniform, and the one in front was wearing a buckskin jacket.
That's our men?
Yes, that's a Tom Custer.
Tom! Tom Custer! Over here!
The rider stopped and looked toward DeRudio's voice.
What the hell?
They're Sioux.